Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
All right, Andrew, can you guess which mega female pop star was on the cover of People magazine the week of March 12th, 1990?
Janet Jackson, mm-hmm. Madonna,
warmer.
Oh, Joan Osborne.
No, she was like 1995-ish.
Oh, Paul Abdul.
Here to perform from her triple platinum album, Forever Your Girl, Paula Abdul.
There you go. So the same week as People magazine hit the newsstands, Paula's song Opposites Attract was in the Billboard Top 10.
Ugh, love me some MC Scat Cat.
Little Mermaid was still in theaters. And so today we'll cover some of our favorite pop music of the early 90s. And get this, we actually will be speaking to Paula Abdul.
It was such an explosive time for me.
Paula, you're forever our girl.
I mean, for sure. Anyway, I'm Jason Sheeler, Deputy West Coast Editor at People Magazine.
And I'm Andrea Laventhal, Style and Beauty Director at People Magazine.
And this is People in the 90s, where each week we dive deep into an issue of People Magazine from the best era ever. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Jason.
Well, I have a theory that I'm going to lay on you. I have a theory that decades don't ever start on time. Just hear me out. Hear me out.
I'm listening.
I feel like the 90s really started in 1994 because that's when Friends, Cameron Diaz, Gianni Versace's safety pin collection, that's when that all happened.
Okay.
1994 is when Bryant Gumbel asked on the Today Show, what is the internet anyway?
Internet is that massive computer network, the one that's becoming really big now.
Oh, my God.
So that's all 1994. That's when I think the 90s really started. So my question to you is, when do you think the 90s started?
Well, now I'm just going to be like 1994 and just regurgitate all the reasons you said, because, wow, what a well thought out theory. I might have to get on board with that. Prior to your dissertation, I would have said 1991, because that's when Pearl Jam's 10 was released. And I don't want to like make it sound like I was like some super cool kid. I think I was in middle school and was like, yeah, man, grunge is the greatest.
I mean, you did just lay Pearl Jam out there. It's a little intimidating. It's a little advanced.
Right. But I'll tell you why. I had a loophole to coolness, and it was called my older brother. And he was super cool and had great taste in music and was always the one to like bring the cool music to the crew. And because I was always lurking around, I picked up what was going on. And for a little while, it was Two Live Crew, which was not a good musical lesson, but it also was Pearl Jam. Mm. And then the whole movement came with grunge fashion and flannels and Seattle and coffee, which I wasn't allowed to drink, but I knew it was something like very cool. And then Marc Jacobs sending the grunge style down the runway when he was designing at Perry Ellis. And I used to watch that stuff on TV. So I knew it was something.
But I have to say, I've been listening to a lot of 90s music lately. And then when I got to Straight Up by Paula Abdul, arguably a seminal 90s bop.
Absolutely.
I was shocked to remember that it was released in late 88. And then 64 weeks later, in 1990, it reached number one.
What?
Yeah. So this, of course, makes a strong argument that the 90s actually started in 1988. And so, of course, by the time Paula reached number one, and her other songs like Forever Your Girl, I mean, like there were like four number ones on that album. She's still tied for number two with most number ones from any one album. Michael Jackson and Katy Perry each have five.
I was going to guess like Mariah. I just feel like Mariah holds every record.
Mariah's tied with her for number two. But it was at the time, Paula Abdul's Forever Girl, the most successful debut album of all time, 18 million copies to date. And then, dun, 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 she landed on the cover of People magazine March 12th of 1990 with the headline, Most Wanted Woman.
It's interesting. We didn't say Most Wanted Girl. I respect that we called her a woman, but it would have been a nice nod to the song. But whatever.
We could have helped her out a little bit. It's worth noting, by the way, that Straight Up, the song, is still currently on the Hot 100 in Poland. Fun fact.
I just thought you were going to say here. And I was like, how is that possible? But I like that it's Poland. So just to recap, you proved your theory that the 90s started in 1994, but then you disproved your theory by saying it actually started in 1988 when Paula Abdul released her first album. But then subsequently, it took 64 weeks to get onto the charts. So then it really started in, what issue was this? March 1990. Wow.
Yes. Let me know when the snake finally eats its tail. But yeah, that was my circular logic to get to the point that the 90s actually didn't start late. It actually started early.
Wow. Wow.
Let's talk about Paula Abdul for a second. Like Paula Abdul, the person, right? Like today we know her for American Idol, right? She had that Bravo reality show.
Hey, Paula.
We know she can still dance. Those Voltaren arthritis commercials where she dances to Forever Your Girl.
I know. What a great spokesperson.
Oh, completely.
Whoever was sitting in that conference room throwing out names, good job. Well done.
She's got a residency in Vegas, which is set to return.
Once you get a residency in Vegas, you're like
you're an icon, right? Like you're a total icon.
It's like Mount Rushmore.
Celine, Britney, J-Lo, Paula Abdul. So, but back in 1990, more specifically the week of March 12, 1990, what we really knew about her is that she was a former LA Lakers cheerleader who like had a significant side hustle as a choreographer. And then one day, like the badass she is, she decided to tell someone, "I can sing," you know. And then suddenly she's a pop star.
And it's like mega pop star.
But can we talk about her choreography for a second? Because like as a dancer, she choreographed stuff for George Michael, Dolly Parton.
Look, Dolly Parton, I bet you no one knows that.
So one of her first things she choreographed for Janet Jackson's Control album that kind of helped put her on the map.
Yeah.
Remember that iconic wedding dance sequence for Coming to America?
It's unreal. The scene in Big with Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks on the piano at F.A.O. Schwartz. But she also did Cuba Gooding Jr.'s end zone dance routine in Jerry Maguire and the cheerleading routine with Mina Savari and Thora Birch in American Beauty. Like, done. So all of these things that she weaves through pop culture. And it was somewhat surprising that, you know, that the top of the charts were dominated by Madonna, Janet Jackson, and Paula Abdul. So she really, I think, helped carve out what the early 90s sounded like. Which was this really addictive pop filled with R&B beats mixed with late 80s synth hooks. Like, Andrea, think of the intro to Straight Up. Think about Depeche Mode's Enjoy the Silence. I mean, one of my favorite songs ever, Janet Jackson's Love Will Never Do Without You. All songs that are super, like, melodically driven and, for lack of a better word, just, like, really catchy. And Paula carried all of that into the 90s.
What was so cool about Paula, too, is that she was always reinventing her vibe, like through her videos, right? Like she became known for doing these really sort of MTV of the moment, what's she going to do next videos, whether she had Scat Cat during Opposites Attract or she was doing Rush Rush with Keanu Reeves. I mean, she really had these like concepts. And what was so cool about her is she always had a reference. She really just like loved musicals and dance and choreographers. So there was always a reason for what she was doing. She was creating something as like a nod to something of the past. It was much deeper than just Keanu Reeves people and Scat Cat.
And then lastly with Paula is like, it's interesting to think about her as a total Hollywood kid because everything she did was super, super cinematic. I think that, you know, part of her songwriting and part of her recording and part of her video was like completely influenced by her Hollywood childhood, which we're going to get to hear about because we are lucky enough to be able to talk to Paula Abdul and hear all of the stories around how she got here and how she recorded all these songs and how she became the most wanted woman in 1990. Well, welcome, Paula Abdul, to People in the 90s. We are so grateful to have you here today.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be doing this, but that's many, many years ago.
Well, here's the thing. We all know that you were only getting started in the 90s, and in particular, March 12th, 1990, because we have something to show you, and that is your cover of People magazine from that week.
Oh, I remember that well.
Yes. So the first question for you is super easy because it's fill in the blank. When you saw yourself on the cover of People magazine, you knew what? What did you know when you saw that cover?
When I saw the cover, I knew that people wanted to know about me. I was shaking. I was like, I couldn't believe that that's me and that everything was happening. It was such an explosive time for me, both with my music, but also as a choreographer, I literally was burning the candle at both ends. Mm. It was a crazy, crazy time. I just remember that I had just moved into my own place at the time of the magazine coming out. But right up to that time, I was living in a 2-bedroom apartment with 4 other Laker girls. So there were 5 of us. You see, I didn't know what was going to happen with my music, and I never wanted to lose my day job as a choreographer. So I didn't tell a lot of people that I was making an album. And so when it did come out, I still was a Laker girl, still a choreographer for the Laker girls, and a choreographer for everyone from the Jacksons and Janet and George Michael and ZZ Top, and it was wild.
I would love to talk about your hits. And Andrew and I have a very passionate debate about which one we like the most. I'm a little cold-hearted snake. She's a little straight up.
Straight up changed my life. How does Straight Up happen? Well, Gemma Corfield, my A&R, amazing human being, introduced me to this new songwriter named Elliot Wolf. And when I heard Straight Up, I was like obsessed with the song, obsessed. And I couldn't wait to meet this guy. So when I go to this apartment building and I meet Elliot Wolf, and I expected this R&B dude, his sounds were so incredibly R&B and funky and different. And he opens the door and I see this slight frame guy with red frizzy hair, Coke bottle glasses, and he's walking in socks around his apartment, and he's kind of quiet. And I'm going, where are we going to be recording? He said, in my shower here. I recorded Straight Up in his little shower. And in the early masters that were released, you could actually hear someone banging from the next apartment doing faintly. I also saw on the cover my mother mentioning a quote. So I was like, oh my God, this is almost perfect. But Mom, why did you say that? Because the caption says, you know, Hollywood's biggest newcomer is selling more records than Madonna. But her mother wants to know, can't she meet a nice man? Great, Mom. Thank you for that.
First of all, your mom sounds like my mom.
My mom only wanted me to find a nice guy.
I was going to say, in the article, she says she gets very defensive about Arsenio and the rumors that you guys are in a relationship and not just friends. She says, Arsenio is a nice guy, says Lorraine, but for God's sakes, can a girl have a close friend without people making more of it than it really is?
Mom of the year.
Mom of the year.
So can you tell us a little bit more about your friendship with Arsenio?
You know what? It's like Arsenio and I were extremely close. At that specific time, there was nothing more than a great friendship. I mean, I will say that Arsenio was one of the funniest, most entertaining companions. And we dated a little bit, but we were meant to always be good friends. And I was his best audience, both him and Eddie, because I would laugh so hard, I'd pee in my pants all the time. And it was embarrassing. So there were a couple of times where I was strengthening my bladder and I didn't pee in my pants. They went, well, now you're a tough audience.
That was their barometer.
You can't win with Eddie and Arsenio.
By the way, John Stamos in this article gave us the funniest quote. He said, we both go to bed early and we both have horrible allergies. He says, I think we discovered we're both a couple of geeks. I couldn't stop laughing at that. To picture the two most famous, beautiful, fabulous people with allergies going to bed early.
Yeah, he's a geek. He's a total geek. And he's a fantastic one. But so was I, a geek at the time. And like, yeah, it was very normal.
Well, Andrew and I are dying to talk about the videos because you helped define, you know, music videos as we see them today. And I definitely want to get into Cold Hearted Snake because you are such a student of dance, obviously. Fosse, all that jazz references. And Paula, those, of course, were directed by David Fincher. I mean, you had really good taste because he also directed Madonna's Express Yourself video. And by the way, for those listening who are wondering why we care so much about this guy, Fincher went on to direct huge and iconic movies in the 90s like Seven and Fight Club and well into the 2000s with The Social Network, Gone Girl, and even last year's Academy Award-nominated film, Mank.
It's amazing.
My favorite video they did was too cold-hearted. And I'll tell you why. For me, it was a mission to give a gift of gratitude to Bob Fosse. And I did my own version of Take Off With Me from All That Jazz. And it was so important for me to do whatever my version was, it would be something he would be so proud of. I worked so hard on that video, and I worked my dancers so hard. And David Fincher was so great to work with because he trusted me as my eye and helping him too. And I just remember it was important for me to be able to give something to Bob Fosse that I'd be proud of. And I was able to get it to him before he passed away. And, you know, between that and Gene Kelly, like, that was my mission, and I was able to do that. And I created during that time a very specific look, a very specific sound. You know, I never claimed to be the best. Listen, I was born with turning hips. I never claimed to be the best dancer, or definitely not the greatest singer. But I always knew I was a great communicator, and I was a real good entertainer. And it was a time that allowed me to really show who I am.
So can we hear about MC Scat Cat? Like, I mean, that is such a part of your legacy and story, and it's almost like something about you that just will not go away.
Okay. So my biggest thing is when I became a recording artist, and I was now being able to do my own choreography, and I wanted to pay gratitude to Gene Kelly. I had an idea. I want to create an animated character myself. I want it to be a cat because Gene Kelly's been well, and he danced with a mouse, and I had already 6 singles out, right? And they said, yeah, well, not on this album. You're going to be overset. You're already oversaturated at radio. You can't have a 7th single out. I said, no, I don't care about a single. I just want to do like a long form video and create my own animated character and give it as a gift to Gene Kelly. Well, they gave in to my tenacity, and I met this husband and wife team, Candace Reckinger and Michael Patterson, their husband and wife, and we turned in the pencil sketch test. And I remember I came in with tear sheets. I wanted to have a fade haircut. I wanted an earring in his ear. I want this cat to be so hip and cool and urban, and I want him to rap. And Virgin Records loved it. And when it was all said and done, guess what? They decided to release a 7th single on my Forever Your Girl album.
And that was Opposites Attract.
And it sold 8 million more copies for me.
Paula, the 90s are everywhere right now. It's a decade we can't seem to get away from. Why do you think we can't forget the 90s? Why can't we move on from the 90s, you think?
I feel like the late 80s and 90s, the best music. Bad for hair and style, but great music. It was happy music. I think everything from the 90s between the music and the artists that were out at that time. I always said I was born in the wrong era because I should have been born during the MGM musical era. But I was born at the right time for music because it was melody, heavy melody driven, happy, kind of feel good. And artists like Madonna, Janet, Michael, we were dancers. We danced. And I think that people are going back and having that nostalgic feeling towards legacy television, music, dance, and everything. And I think that there are incredible artists that are out to date. However, it's amazing that the 90s had such influential artists at the time. And I think that performance was very important.
Are you grateful that there was no social media when you were on your rise to stardom?
Well, honestly, we dealt with tabloids. That was the thing that you had to like juggle with and worry about if it's bad press or like. It wasn't until and I was at the height of my success then. And then I got sidelined by many. I had to have many neck surgeries. I was in a crash landing plane that people think that didn't happen, but it did. It's just that there was no internet at the time. I had people that were with me on the plane, like Bob Cavallo, who was my manager, and Marty Hahn, my tour manager, and my best friend, Daniel, and Emilio was on the plane at the time. So it's like funny that people argue that it didn't happen because there's no proof. But my only defense was NDAs at the time.
Right.
I didn't want people to count me out, but I was seriously injured. And I disappeared for almost 7 years. And then I reappeared on a brand new show called American Idol. And that was my first taste of, oh my God, social media. Because my first season of Idol, there were just message boards, and that was bad enough. You know what I mean? So it was like, yeah. And I think, wow, it's so different now. It was just a whole different thing.
So our last question for you is, if you could go back to March 12, 1990 and give yourself any advice, what would you tell yourself?
This business isn't for the weak. You have to have or develop a thick skin. And I just remember that, you know, at the time, you know, this industry can make you feel like you'll never get hired again, or you'll never get a hit again, or this, that, and the other. So I would say yes to everything. I would say yes, yes. And because of that, I missed a lot of my friendships. I missed a lot of family outings and trips that I go back. If I were to tell my younger self, I would be more discerning. Don't be afraid to say no. And no one can stop your talent. No one can stop and take that away from you. You got to believe in yourself, because if you don't believe in yourself, it doesn't matter if other people do. And most likely, if you don't believe in yourself, you're not going to have an air of confidence. And that's like, I would always believe in the hard work that I did. And that I'm glad that I was raised during a time when work ethic was really important. And I was raised at a very young age to understand how to walk in gratitude.
I love that. Where did that come from? Who taught you that?
My dad taught me at a very young age as a kid. He would tell me, you got to go out there and remember, you're an Abdul. God damn it, you're an Abdul. I grew up thinking, God damn it was the best word. You're a goddamn Abdul. Now you go out there, okay? That's my dad was my biggest cheerleader. And my mom was like, oh God, please become a doctor, please. You know, and the thing is that he gave me these nuggets of wisdom. He said, listen, honey, remember this. They can say no all they want, but remember that no is the beginning of a negotiation. All right, now go out there and show me an Abdul.
No, it's just the beginning of your negotiation.
Ladies and gentlemen, Paula Abdul, thank you so much.
Thank you all so much.
I mean, well, there you have it, Paula Abdul. I mean, enter my head spinning.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there.
Let's just debrief. So we've got John Stamos, the plane crash, Arsenio Hall.
Like, we knew that there were rumors that she and Arsenio were dating at the time, but to get a confirmation from her.
I mean, like, breaking news 31 years later. Also, who was bigger than Arsenio Hall in the early 90s? I mean, that show, like, I remember, like, Bill Clinton playing the saxophone. Like, that show was everything.
Hey, guys.
Yes.
Hi, producer Chris.
Sorry to interrupt, but Arsenio Hall is paging us right now.
Of course he is.
Wait, we got Arsenio Hall?
Yeah, he's calling people in the 90s to tell us about some of his favorite moments from hosting the Arsenio Hall show.
It was great. You know, you didn't have Twitter. You know, there was no black Twitter. If there was a black Twitter, I was black Twitter. You know, I remember getting calls from like Tupac saying, hey man, I got some problems going on. Can I come over and talk about an incident that happened in the club? You know, that's where you explain yourself. That's where Bill Clinton came to try to reach a younger audience.
That's how I learned to inhale, play it by saxophone. You blow out, and then you have to inhale.
Those were great times, and I love offering that platform. You know, getting a call from Michael Jackson saying he's coming. I don't need to go on, but you know, I'll just stand over in the side. I remember Michael came, he was standing on the side with a glass of orange juice. And the reason I remember this is he had on a KN95. He had on one of those masks. And I didn't get my KN95 till last year. I remember Whitney Houston just popping by to hang out.
Whitney Houston, ladies and gentlemen.
Let's really lie. Let's get down deep.
My green room was like the ultimate party sometimes. There were times when I was interviewing somebody on the air, wishing I was in my green room, because I knew that David Spade and Whitney Houston were probably back there.
His green room, I mean, can you imagine just being a fly on the wall there?
Thanks, Arsenio. That was really awesome.
And of course, an even bigger thanks to Paula Abdul.
Hey everyone, I'm Sid Evans, editor-in-chief of Southern Living and host of Biscuits and Jam. Since 2020, I've been interviewing musicians, chefs, authors, and other Southern icons about their family traditions, their faith, their favorite meals, and of course, what it means to be Southern. And I'm excited to announce season 5 of our award-winning podcast. Join me every Tuesday for new conversations with some of the most interesting and influential Southerners around. Be sure to follow Biscuits and Jam wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us online at southernliving.com/biscuitsandjam.
Okay, Jason, as your Fabio editor, I'm going to need an update on where we're at with Chasing Fabio.
Well, I'll tell you, my new title here at People Magazine is Jason Sheeler, Senior Editor, Fabio. And I did reach out to who I found as a rep of sorts for Fabio, and I let them know that we're working on a new podcast, People Magazine, and that we would love to interview Fabio. I'd be happy to jump on the phone to discuss further. As it turns out, I inadvertently contacted the president of the Fabio fan club. Her name is Donna May. She has a PhD.
I'm sorry, pardon. You said PhD, like she has her doctorate in Fabio?
Let's assume she has a PhD in Fabio. But her name is Donna May. She's president of the Fabio fan club. And she kindly, and I mean kindly, let me know that she's forwarding my request to Fabio's agent. Parentheses, I just run the fan club.
First of all, Donna, you don't just run the fan club. Don't
selling yourself short.
Yeah, Donna, you run the fan club, positive. And the fact that she's so tight with his agent that she could just like forward this correspondence says a lot about how he feels about his fans in a very positive way. So that's nice. So you think that it's going to make its way to the agent?
I did. I wrote back to her and I said, help us, Donna May. You are our only hope.
If that's not going to get it, nothing will.
No pressure. No pressure, Donna May, but you're all we've got. So I shall report back next episode.
Get him, Jason. Go get our boy.
Was that a Sex and the City reference?
Yes, everything is a Sex and the City reference.
So, Andrea, if you can please turn in your hymnal to page 50, I have to hear what you think about Milli Vanilli. There is a 2-page spread all about them, and it is titled Milli Vanilli's Two Heads Hope Their Grammy Award Puts an End to Silly Vanilli Jokes.
Wait, that's the actual... Wait, I have to... I'm turning. This is insane.
We printed that.
So Milli Vanilli became a punchline. They were exposed for never singing on their albums. They had that horrible lip sync snafu that makes Ashley Simpson's look like no big deal. Remember that? All that being true, I also think Girl, You Know It's True is a great song.
Girl, You Know It's True is a really great song. Blame It on Rain is a really great song. I think they both peaked at number 2, if I'm not mistaken. But they did sadly have to return their Grammy Award for Best New Artist.
They did.
They did try later in the 90s, in 1988, they did record a comeback album of sorts called Back and In Attack, but its release was actually canceled after Rob died.
It's just so sad. They put so much effort into their appearance, their brand, all of that, only to be like a punchline. But their narrative would have been so different now. They would have come out and they would have said, we are a victim of the music industry. We were sort of duped into selling our brands, and we are talented and we want to prove it. And then they would be like YouTube stars and doing like hair tutorials.
I think that's really interesting, actually. I feel like you're pitching a documentary here. There may be like a Justice for Milli Vanilli documentary in the works by Andrea Laventhal.
It's really funny that you say that, Jason, because I was so moved. And apparently, there have been several films or documentaries in the works, but they just haven't gotten off the ground. And I will be looking into those and seeing if there's a Kickstarter campaign, and I will probably contribute.
Well, the most majorly 90s thing about Milli Vanilli are these earworms, right? These earworms we could never get away from one hit or even one album artists. So my question for you, favorite one-hit wonder of the 90s. And you can't say Torn by Natalie Imbruglia because that's mine.
Would you consider Lisa Loeb a one-hit wonder with Stay?
Yes, for sure. You say,
well, there you go. She's mine. Right off the top of the head. Anyway, I just say justice for Milli Vanilli, the hair, all of it.
All right, Andrew, one last thing. Remember the indie, like the true independent film, the little art house, low budget, like genre defining movies, like those things that like always shook up the Oscars, like for Miramax, right? Like Crying Game, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Kids, Dazed and Confused.
I think of all of the Kevin Smith movies too.
Oh,
right?
Mallrats.
Clerks, Chasing Amy. I loved all those.
And it Chasing Amy
made me feel cool to watch them, even if I didn't get everything. You would like drop it into conversation so people knew that you were legit. Legit what? I don't know, just something.
But then there's like the cult indie and like not Showgirls, like the super gay indie, like again, not Showgirls. Like remember like Serial Mom with Kathleen Turner, Pecker with Christina Ricci. And in this very issue of People magazine, we gave a small shout out to Crybaby, starring Johnny Depp and Ricky Lake, and oddly, Tracy Lords and Willem Dafoe. But all of those were by John Waters. The guy's now 75, and he made iconic and campy movies like Pink Flamingos in the 70s, Hairspray in the 80s. But it was in the 90s when all the major stars were lining up to appear in his movies. And of course, the ultimate 90s cult movie is John Waters' Serial Mom. I mean, every time I wear white, especially after Labor Day, all I can hear in my mind is this.
You can't wear white shoes after Labor Day.
That's not true anymore.
Yes, it is. Didn't your mother ever tell you? Now you know.
That is so 90s.
Well, thanks again to Paula Abdul for being our guest today. I mean, Andrea, I feel like we learned a hell of a lot in this episode. What was your biggest takeaway?
Probably not to have lunch in Hollywood with Paula Abdul, because it sounds like she knows literally everyone and you would never actually get to sit down at your table because she would have to stop and say hi to like every music producer, film producer, videographer, photographer, choreographer, and you'd be like, damn it, I just want to order a drink, Paula.
I know, it's like leaving church with my aunt. But I do still love the Ivy though. I mean, iconic. People in the 90s is hosted by me, Jason Scheeler, and Andrea Laventhal. It's produced by Jason Scheeler and Chris Jacobs, executive produced by Kim Ritberg and David Flumenbaum, edited by Chris Jacobs, mastered by Erica Wong, and with production support by Aliza Sessler at People, Persia Verlin, Matt Sav, and Rachel King at Pod People.
I'm Andrea Laventhal. Thank you for listening.
And I'm Jason Scheeler.